I thought I would describe kind of an overview of the project that we've had going on for several years to model a local patch of the primary visual cortex for monkey. And I think some of my colleagues will be coming through the course of the semester, so I thought I'd try to overview the project as it currently stands. And so we're going to study the primary visual cortex, which in monkey or human is a region of the brain back here, about the size of a credit card in lateral extent. And it's actually a stack of 6 credit cards because it's a layered structure as you go into the brain. And we'll be these layers are labeled 1 through 6 from the skull inward. And I'll only be describing today an attempt to model a local patch of the input layer 4C alpha, which is one of the 2 main input layers in monkey, 4C alpha and 4C beta. And so that's the layer that I'll be focusing on, is this input layer. And so the work is with Bob Shapley and Mike Shelley, together with 2 postdocs, Lewis Tao and Jim Wiedlard. And Bob has got an arrow next to his name because as a mathematician or a physicist getting into this business, it would be hopeless for Mike and I if it weren't for the interactions with Shapley. So I think it's absolutely essential in the project. If you think about the visual pathway, then information enters through the retina, on through the LGN, and into this input layer 4C alpha of V1, and then it goes on for further processing. And so we're really looking at the front end of the system. And the reason we chose the primary visual cortex to model is there are many reasons. One reason, of course, is that Bob's own research program has moved from the retina through the LGN and onto V1 over some 30 years of work, and so that it's natural just with our collaboration with Bob. But in addition to that, this front end V1 is a place where neurons serve as elementary feature detectors of the visual scene. Very elementary features such as orientation of edges. And in addition, because it's early in the pathway and because it's relatively easy to access, there's a lot of experimental information about it. In particular, there's a lot of the temporal behavior of the input from the LGN is extremely well understood experimentally, and the anatomy of V1 is well understood as well, due to work of Loon, Calloway, and others. Now, in addition, this region is the region of visual process. It's the cortical region for visual processing that has the finest spatial resolution, and you'd expect that because it's the input region. And so, any spatial resolution that you lose at the input, you've lost forever. But you also, since it's the only place where you find this fine scale resolution, you can conjecture that V1 may also be useful not only as a region of elementary feature detection, but also as a region for a representation if you want to represent very fine scale detail. And everything on this slide is experimental fact except the last point, which is still quite controversial. But in any case, these are some of the reasons why we decided to look at this front end part of the processing, because we thought that the processing in this front end would be elementary enough that you might have a chance to model it with a large-scale computer model. So our model itself is a detailed fine-scale model of, as I say, of an input layer, actually a local patch of the input layer. And we try to work very hard to constrain the model with experimental data as much as we can. At the same time, we try to make a rather minimal model in the sense that we attempt not to posit assumptions that are not established experimentally. So for example, we don't use Hebbian wiring schemes because in our view they have not been established experimentally as yet. So those would be further constraints on the architecture that we don't place on them, on our model.
You mean Hebbian-induced by wiring schemes induced by Hebbian elements?
Yeah, for example, connections which favor like orientation, or connections with fate which favor anti-phase preferences. We don't wire in such schemes. I don't mean we also are not doing any Hebbian learning. We're not updating the synaptic strings. But even the hardwired synaptic strings, we don't use a kind of an orientation preference, for example, in the wiring scheme. So I wanted to start then with an overview of what I will cover today. So that you and then the last slide of the talk will put up this same overview. So as I mentioned, we have a rather detailed fine scale model. We focus on one feature, orientation detection, and the selectivity and the diversity of the orientation detectors arises within the model entirely from cortical activity. We will talk about orientation maps with pinwheel singularities, and the neurons will be more selective, will turn out to be more selective when they're near the pinwheel centers than away within this model. The model consists of simple cells and captures the linearity of simple cells. Even though the cells themselves and the network coupling is nonlinear, but the general response is linear, and that's captured with the model. The model has complex cells, but that part of the work is not as far along. I'll describe where we're at and what our difficulties are in the complex cell part of the study, but it's not as far along as the rest of the modeling in this overview slide is. The model operates in a very high conductance state. When you make the model, we don't place it in that state. But when you place the model in a kind of a robust region of its phase and parameter spaces, so that it's reproducing observed cortical experiments, it is in a high conductance state at that point in time, and that high conductance state is a state which gets even higher when you stimulate the model with visual stimulus. So in a certain sense, now high conductance is going to lead to a separation of time scale. And so what's happening is when you stimulate this model, you get an emergent separation of time scales that emerges from activity. And
which are the time scales which are different?
Well, I'll make that clear in a moment, but the conductance time scale, so that the relaxation time scale of the network, is the shortest time scale in the model, and it's faster than synaptic time scales when you drive it hard. When you don't drive it, when you're in background or in, spontaneous. If you're in a spontaneously, then those two time scales, the conductance size and the, or one over the conductance size, and the synaptic time scales are roughly the same. So activity causes that separation to emerge so that the fastest time scale becomes one over the conductance. And in addition, so what I'm going to be telling you about mostly today is a large scale computing model that consists of 16,000 neurons per millimeter squared. So a very large-scale scientific computing project. But we also can use asymptotics to coarse-grain that to obtain a coarse-grain model for average firing rates. And with that coarse-grain model, you can start to do analysis, and even more importantly, you can start to think about scaling up the model to a much more global object or a global representation. And so we have now developed this coarse-grained representation. We're beginning to think about using it to parameterize larger scale modeling. And so that kind of summarizes where the project is at. And as I say, we'll walk through parts of this today, and then at the end I'll put up this same slide, and if it doesn't already make sense to you, it will by that time, I think. So the features of our model, it's a local patch, 1 millimeter squared in lateral area of its input layer. So that's quite a tiny region of V1. And it's an integrate and fire point neuron model. So the individual neurons are modeled very idealistically with integrate and fire dynamics. There's a anatomically correct number of them. It's a two population model, excitatory and inhibitory neurons, 12,000 excitatory and 4,000 inhibitory. As I mentioned, it's a patch, 1 square millimeter, which will contain 4 hypercolumns. Most of you know what that means, but those that don't will define it in a minute. But it's a local patch. The orientation preference of the neurons, of each individual neuron, is hardwired in from the convergent LGN input. So the preference, the angles that the neurons prefer, is hardwired in. The coupling architecture, we try very hard to set it by anatomy. The connections themselves are all local connections because we're only doing a local patch, and so they're isotropic in cortical space. Excitation is longer range than inhibition, which is one of the ways that we differ from many other models. And we believe that the anatomical measurements indeed show that the excitation is longer range than inhibition. And the model is not only works in a high conductance regime, but it works in a regime where cortical inhibition dominates. So the model is an overdamped network, if you like. So the integrate and fire equations, the integrate part of them, I guess.
You say that the orientation preference is coming from the GM, but not the tumor.
Not the selectivity or the diversity, but the preference, the angle that each neuron prefers, is coming from the LGN. It's going to be very broadly tuned, very and the network will sharpen it. That's right. So these integrate and fire equations are for the voltages of the individual neurons. J is a cortical label that runs around this two-dimensional layer of the cortex. And sigma just labels whether it's an excitatory or inhibitory neuron. All of the coupling, I guess I didn't bring my pointer, but all of the coupling is through the G's. So you'll see the coupling in the next slide or so. Oh yeah, there's a pointer, thank you. So all the coupling is hidden hidden inside. So this J-th neuron couples to all the other neurons in the network through the inside of these G's. And these are constants that essentially tell you whether or not the individual terms are an excitatory term or an inhibitory term, depending on the values of those constant reversal potentials. So that's the nature of the network. As I mentioned, all the coupling takes place through the G's. So let's take a look briefly at what the G's look like. So the excitatory G's come in 3 flavors. Excitatory input from the LGN. So this is where the visual signal is driving the network, is through this term. The network is very noisy. It's primarily synaptic noise, so the noise is on the synaptic timescales, which are 5 to 10 millisecond timescale. And the cortical coupling terms, have, as I mentioned, longer range excitation than inhibition, and they're local couplings, so they're assumed to be isotropic in cortical space. The inhibitory conductances are the same, except there's no LGN drive. And other than that, they have the same structure as the...
So what do you mean by local? Out of these 16...
Local has to do with...
Spatially local.
Yeah, spatially local. And this two-dimensional layer is tiled, if you like, by certain subunits called the columns or hypercolumns. And in a millimeter squared, there's roughly 4 of these hypercolumns. And long-range connections would couple hypercolumns several millimeters away. And the short-range connections more or less talk to neurons within a hypercolumn.
Everyone talks to everyone else.
Well, the closer they are together, the stronger they talk. But in the model, we don't have any of these long-range connections to far-away hypercolumns, of course, because we're not modeling far-away hypercolumns. So now the local anatomical couplings appear to be isotropic in space. And that's the assumption that I'm making.
How does that strength vary with...
We use a Gaussian. It falls off. Exactly what how it falls off is not so clear. We use a Gaussian in distance.
Are longer tails than that?
It's not so clear that it's known. It falls off, and we fit it with a Gaussian. So I guess I didn't have on this... overhead. Now let me go on. I think I'm going to have to go to the blackboard for a second. But let me go on and see if it's not buried deeper in the presentation. So I haven't shown you the couplings. That's what I'm missing. And it should be right here, but it's not. So let me go to the blackboard and tell you what those couplings look like.
What about the equilibrium potentials of excitation and inhibition?
The values of them?
Yeah. Hyperpolarizing inhibition, shunting inhibition.
I think the answer is no. I mean, the inhibition is basically GABA A, and is modeled roughly with the time courses of GABA A, and that's the only inhibition that we have in the system.
Because recently there has been evidence for a lot of GABA B shunting type inhibition.
We don't have anything that slow in the cortex. In our model of the cortex. And
I'm referring to the work by Fred Mack and David Kirsch in the last 2 years.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's GABA B.
Seems to be close to the equilibrium potential, or to the resting potential.
Yeah, I think that may be... Let's discuss that later. I think that's making... Well, I think that's mixing up network properties with individual synaptic properties. But so we certainly have things like divisive inhibition coming in. But it's a network property, and it's not a property of the individual synapses. And
well, you know, there was a long-standing controversy because 20 years ago, Rodney Douglas and Kirby Martin and also other people like David First have reported no shunting inhibition in cortex in the cat.
Yeah, no.
Recordings. Now in the last 2 years, this seems to have changed.
That's right, and we believe that our results are consistent with those recent observations, but not due to the input of the model, but how the model behaves in network. So we actually think that the model is in the regime that Furster and Judith Hirsch and Frenyak and so forth, this so-called high conductance regime and a high inhibitory conductance regime where the inhibition acts like a divisive inhibition. We think the network is in that state, but not because we put in individual neurons or individual synapses which force it in that state. So, David?
Well, I think that the level of modeling, that you, there's not really a clear difference between people that I and that we examples are constant. When there's a shunting of one function, since you have to change the parameter, to play with the parameters, you find going to be similar. The main question I see is the fact that the models are particularly strong, a big change in input conditions of neurons, mainly coming from inhibition.
But it makes a difference if you have them on dendrites or so. But anyway, that's
a point like
you have, I think. So the conductances are of the form of a sum over the conductance coming into the jth neuron is of the form of a sum over the k neuron and a sum over the spikes that go with the k neuron so let's talk about the excitatory to excitatory conductance. There'll be a coupling strength SEE. And then there'll be a coupling matrix AJK, which is spatial. And then there'll be a time course G for the excitatory synapse that looks like that, where this is the spike time of the ELF spike time of the kth neuron. So when the kth neuron spikes the ELF time, it interacts with the jth neuron according to this formula. And that's how the interactions. And then the spiking themselves are defined, if you look at the kth neuron at time tk, at time tkl, it's equal to 1. So every time this voltage crosses this normalized firing threshold 1, you say the thing spikes, you keep track of when it spikes, and you reset immediately later to 0 and let the thing go on. So in the model, you're not modeling the spikes themselves, but you're keeping track of when the neurons spike. And at each spike time, that's how that spiking neuron talks to its neighbors through this formula. And so the modeling comes in selecting these, in first of all, assuming that the conductances space-time separate that way. And then secondly, fixing the length scales that are inherent in here and the time scales that are inherent in here. And that's where we use the physiological time scales and the anatomically measured length scales. And so that's the type of coupling that we have, and that's how one neuron talks to another. G I guess they call it an alpha function. It looks like that, where this is an exponential decay, and this rise time is kind of polynomial, so it looks like t to a power e to the minus t over epsilon. And we choose the cortical conductances. For example, this is 4 milliseconds for excitatory synapses, and about 6 milliseconds for inhibitory synapses. So these are fast cortical synapses of AMPA and GABA A, and
what is the anatomy look like?
So I'll show pictures of the anatomy in a moment, but these local connections we assume are isotropic. So AJK, we assume is a function of the distance j minus k with a fall off, and the actual function we use is Gaussian.
Three-dimensional distance?
two-dimensional, so on a layer. Because we're only modeling right now one layer, although our hope is to build a model that contains three layers. But anyway, right now we're just modeling the input layer. So two-dimensional distance fall off is Gaussian, and the link scales are such that the excitatory neurons have a slower fall off. They talk over longer distances than the inhibitory neurons.
One neuron would be talking to how many other ones in that Gaussian?
Well, that's a good question. Lots, but so there's 16,000 in this 1 millimeter array. The fall off of the excitatory neurons is about, and so this is 1,000 microns. The fall off of the excitatory neurons is about 400 microns, and the fall off of the inhibitory neurons is about, the half width is about 200 microns. So I don't know. There's 16,000 spread in there, and they're falling off by a Gaussian. So I don't know, several hundred. Certainly, each neuron will talk to several hundred others.
What about the dynamics in the synaptic depression?
Don't have it. There's no. So the dynamics is entirely just with these.
That's right.
There's dynamics associated with the LG and drive. This is the cortical stuff. There's the LGN drive has its own kernels, and those kernels, 4C alpha is a so-called is a magno layer, and so the G coming from the LGN looks like this. I don't remember the numbers, but it's quite long. It's probably 40 milliseconds to here, probably 120 milliseconds to here. And the mean is zero because it's a magno layer. So the LGN drive is much slower than the cortical time. Yeah.
What about the strength of inhibition versus
that? Well, I'll show you those numbers, but that's built into the S's essentially. So the S matrix that we use is something like 1, 1.5, 9, and 9. This is the inhibitory column, so it's strongly over-inhibited. However, remember that the inhibitory ranges are smaller, so it's not as over-inhibited as this would make it look, because you have to count up how many neurons. And there's also fewer inhibitory neurons, so their ranges are smaller and there's fewer of them. So this is not as over-inhibited as it looks, but it's still, when you look at the responses, it's by factors of two overbalanced in favor of inhibition. In terms of current, yeah. That's also right. That's right. So now I want to turn to what I think most people in here know, but what are the individual neurons in this network doing? In V1, they're supposed to be elementary feature detectors, so they're supposed to respond very well to very elementary features of the visual scene, like the orientation of edges. So one neuron will like this orientation and its neighbor, and respond very well when it sees this orientation. And its neighbor will like this orientation and respond very well when it sees this. And so it could be a feature detector, where the feature is orientation, because it certainly does respond well to these kind of signals in a very, and if you walk around the network, the neurons respond very differently to different orientations, and so the network could be acting as an orientation detection system, for example. So anyway, I said that we'll focus on orientation. Here's three important elementary features. So what part of the visual scene the neuron is looking at? That's called the receptive field, and these receptive fields are quite small. That's one of the things I meant when I said that their spatial resolution was fine. So spatial location is one of the features. Spatial phase, if this is the receptive field of the neuron in question, these neurons, at least some of them, so-called simple cells, will respond very well to locations within that receptive field, and as you move over a little bit, they'll respond poorly. And so they're able to discriminate within their receptive field quite well. One way to see that is to put a grating on it. And then they'll respond well if the grating has this phase, and very badly if you move the phase over 45 or 90 degrees. And then if you go to a different neuron, they respond well to a different phase, and badly when you slide it by 90 degrees. And so so that's what I mean by spatial phase as a feature. And then the angle of the edges, not the phase, but its angle. And for this talk, you have to keep track of the fact that I'm labeling spatial phase by phi, and remember what that is. And then orientation angle by theta, and remember what that is. So the main purpose of this slide is to define the angles phi and theta so that you know what they are physically. Right. And so most of our work is with grating stimuli, and so this is the type of grating patterns that are shown on the computer or the television screen, and that they will be moving or standing. A standing pattern would be such a pattern not moving, but the blackness of the black would be oscillating through gray and back to black in time. And so you could put some so if you had a so-called contrast there, you could have a sinusoidal oscillation, but not due to drift, but rather due to the contrast modulation or the contrast oscillation. And so we'll be talking about both standing and drifting patterns. And then, as I mentioned, there's two angles that are relevant, and what's pictured there is theta. And if you just slid the left hand, if you slid this picture over a little bit, you'd be capturing phi. And so those are the two angles, those are the two features that I'll be focusing on, is theta and phi. And now what experimentalists do is they measure orientation tuning curves. So this is just firing rate of the neurons, of a neuron. No population average, nothing like that. This is the firing rate of one neuron as a function of the angle of the stimulus. So you change that angle and you calculate the firing rate, and you change it and you calculate the fire, or you measure the firing rate. And that's what's plotted here for three neurons on the left-hand side.
You say no average, but it's important to know that it's average over time.
It's average over time. Very, very, absolutely. It's averaged over many presentations of the signal, but it's not. But it's not averaged over the population. It's measured at one neuron.
Might be the same. I mean, some people
could be the same, but it's a single neuron measurement.
Why is it not periodic in pi? Is that noise?
No.
Let's
go back to this. So you correctly observe that you can't tell the difference between 0 and 180 unless motion is brought into the story. So those figures were for drifting gratings, so they drift one way, and therefore the way they're drifting enables you to use angle from 0 to 2 pi, or 0 to 360, where half of that range is drifting to the right and the other half is drifting to the left. Therefore, this neuron is direction selective as well as angle selective, whereas this neuron is not direction selective. So as I say, these are three different neurons. And the main purpose of this slide is to show you how experimental data is laid down, and also to define orientation preference. So this neuron, or these three neurons, prefer 90 degrees. And so I'll refer to that as orientation preference. And also to define orientation selectivity. Now, orientation selectivity is a measure of how good of a feature detector this neuron is. So if it's going to measure 90 degrees well, you hope when you get a little ways away from 90 degrees, it doesn't respond. And so you capture that by half width. The broader the half width, the worse the feature detector is. Or you capture that by peak to trough. And the bigger peak to trough is, you would say it's a better feature detector. So in either case, that's the difference between orientation preference, which is hardwired into our model, and orientation selectivity, which is defined as how good of a feature detector these things are, which is certainly not hardwired into the model.
You say orientation preference is hardwired, but in fact, if you simulate your network, there is no guarantee that what you do will be the same as what you put in as intelligent input. So did you make some special effort to so that these two things match, or just
I don't know that we made a special effort, but that could happen, but doesn't. In other words,
that's right.
The network did not change the orientation preference. Because we're not in the marginal mode regime, but rather we're in the feed forward regime, where the preference is being set by the feed forward connection. But anyway,
when you say it didn't change, absolutely didn't change. It was a small change, and didn't look at it.
Probably a small change and we didn't look at it, but the global patterns are the same as the input patterns. When you look at the 1 millimeter slice of cortex, mm-hmm. and you compare the input preferences with the observed preferences. And
so you don't have any lateral connections because of this?
No, we have lateral connections, and they're going to change the selectivity of the network very well, but they're not going to touch the preferences of the network.
The initial preferences are completely random?
No, I'll show that in a minute, but they're put in a way to reproduce optical imaging measurements of the optical map, of the orientation map.
It could be could come from some symmetry of the network.
There were
no like rotations of this preference.
Well, that's right.
The lateral connections are symmetric.
The lateral connections are symmetric and therefore it's not through the lateral connections that we're hardwiring in the preferences, it's with the feed forward connections that we're hardwiring them in. So for example, if you shut off the driving, there would be no orientation preferences, and therefore it's hard without something like long range orientation specific connections to for this network to reproduce what you've been talking about. That's right. So anyway, that's what this says. Models receive their orientation preference from convergent LG and input. And what I want to show next is I want to show the orientation maps. So what I mean by an orientation map is that how does the orientation preference of the kth neuron change as you move k around in the two-dimensional lattice. All right. So these are these optical imaging measurements that Blaisdell did in the 90s, and many people do them now, which show that orientation preference optically. And so what's color coded? So what you're looking at is a pretty big slab of the cortex. You're looking at an outer layer, probably 2-3, and then you use extracellular measurements to deduce that this orientation, at least, you pick a random location, and then you go into the cortex with extracellular electrode measurement, and learn that the orientation doesn't change as you go vertically into the cortex, and so it's seen on the outer layers, and then when you combine it with selective probes, you can extend this into layer 4 where we are working.
How many measurements does it take to make a map like this?
Let me just think how it's done. First of all, it's done at different when Gary did this, there's a big signal to noise problem. So what they do is they simply cut off a piece of the skull, and they simply look with regular light. It's not even laser light, but the color of the light is quite important. Choose the color right, and so you get back a very noisy image, and the reflectivity of the light depends on, so people have to correct me when I start saying things wrong, but my understanding is the reflectivity of the light depends on the local oxygen content, and the local oxygen content depends on how rapidly the neurons are firing in that area. And so you're indirectly measuring neuronal activity, although you're actually directly measuring oxygen content. And so the first thing you learn is that the blood vessels screw up what you're looking at. So you have to choose a color of light that you immediately learn the signal's very noisy. So you choose a color of light that minimizes the observation of blood vessels. And that was one of Gary's contributions, was to realize what color was best for that. Other people were running at a different color. Now, what the colors were. Then you have to do differential imaging in these days, in the early 90s. So you would show a drifting grating at one angle, and you would show the drifting grating at the orthogonal angle, and you'd subtract the two images. And that would give you one little piece of this picture for one angle, and then you'd have to do it for many angles in order to get this color coding. So if you use dyes, you can get much better signal to noise. But then dyes are toxic. So at this point in time, the existing dyes were very toxic, and they were screwing up the measurements. So this is without dyes. This is, what's it called?
Intrinsic
imaging. But with a lot of averaging over time, in order to pull the signal out of the noise, and using this differential imaging trick.
Wouldn't some water?
Yeah, maybe it would. It would be good. Nowadays, at least one laboratory has discovered dyes which are not very toxic. That enables them to not do the time averaging, but in single passes to be able to get similar pictures. And so this is no longer state-of-the-art technology, but it was 10 years ago. Black regions are drawn in by hand, as I understand it, because with so this is showing gratings at different angles and color coding them. But in addition, you can show one eye or the other eye, and this cortex has the property that the left eye dominantly excites this slab. The right eye dominantly excites this slab. The belief is if you went all the way to layer 4, maybe it's not belief, it's probably fact, if you go all the way to layer 4, this is 2, 3, this is an outer layer because you're looking in from on top. In fact, the left eye would light up this region and would not light up this region at all. So in layer 4, it's monocular. But by the time it gets to 2, 3, it's just a dominant statement. But nevertheless, though, this is where the left eye is dominant. This is where the right eye is dominant. And he drew in by hand the dividing line so that you could see how the ocular dominance bands fit with the orientation map, fit together with the orientation map. The other thing you notice is the orientation map is nice and regular, but it does have these interesting singularities. And so on the next slide, I highlighted those singularities for you. And so you can see the singularities tend to sit in the middle of these ocular dominance bands. The isoorientation lines cross these dividing lines perpendicularly. And you can see it's a pretty regular tiling of the cortex. Now, the region that we're modeling is going to be a little 1 millimeter squared region consisting of 4 of these pinwheel singularities. So that gives you a feeling as to what a little tiny part of this one layer that we are actually modeling.
Did you have ocular dominance in your model?
Yes, that is correct. We do, although in most of the data I'm going to show you, we in contrast with the experimental data, is that the eyes are both illuminated simultaneously. So I'll be showing you data where all four of these pinwheels light up. But if we really showed monocular data with one eye, then you would only see half of it light up, and that was in the model. So that's the orientation map of preference. This is the angle that these neurons prefer. And so this is the little blow up of that 1 millimeter region. Now, we hardwire that in through the part of the LGN forcing that is that I call GLGN. So we argue that it's convergent LGN data that hardwires that preference into the model. But we don't hardwire in any selectivity or diversity. And so those are emergent properties of the model. So this returns to that same slide that I showed earlier. And now I want to focus on this side of the slide, which is three neurons from the 16,000. And all you can do with that is take a look at it and say, well, it looks similar to three experimental neurons. I mean, you can't conclude anything from looking at three neurons. But you do see how the typical neurons in the model respond. And this line here is quite important, because what that line is one neuron in the network. If you shut off all of the cortical activity, all the cortical connections, so that neuron is only talking to the LGN.
So that's what you mean by preference.
And so that shows you the preference that's hardwired in at 90 degrees for this particular neuron, but also shows you the bad peak to trough values, indicating that this input is not very selective at all, at least with peak to trough measurements. And now every neuron receives this hardwired input. The only difference is the angle that it likes moves around as the neuron's location moves around in the cortex. All right. So in particular, this peak to trough value is the input that's received by every neuron in the model. Now you could say, well, that's not realistic. Different neurons would receive different peak to trough model. But here is the place where we want to make a point with the model, that when you put in the same selectivity for every neuron, nevertheless, a diversity in selectivity emerges, and of course, a considerable sharpening can emerge. And that's illustrated further on the next slide.
What I'm saying?
Yeah.
What happens to spontaneous activity? That is, if you shut the LGN off, maintaining the...
Yeah, we make sure that the way we benchmark our model is to make sure that the spontaneous activity is approximately correct. So, for example, in absence of LGN drive, the model is set up so that the neuron, typical excitatory neuron, is about four or five spikes per second on average, and the distribution of those spikes as you go from neuron to neuron is roughly consistent with things that Meckler has measured. So however, I actually believe that these modeling efforts should spend a lot more time on actually modeling background, and I'm trying to push our group to actually start modeling background, because I think you could learn an awful lot about the cortex by looking at background responses. And that's starting to show up in experimental work that's rising in the last few years. So there's Meckler's work in Shapley's lab, there's work from Grinfeld's lab, there's work from Furster's lab, looking at background activity. And I think we can learn an awful lot about the real cortex by actually trying to model background activity and then comparing the two. So we've done some of that in setting up our model, but I don't think we've done enough.
Going to Misha's point here, I actually see that the preference, actually the orientation selectivity shifts quite a bit compared to the...
I think we just slid. In other words, we slid these curves so these three neurons all had the same orientation preference. And this one was just a sample neuron with roughly the same, but it's not at the same physical location as these three. So I don't think you should read into this shift. That's a graphic shift that we did by hand rather than, or by choice if you like, or by bad choice if you like, rather than an estimate of the shift.
The net code breaks the 180 degree symmetry that you had put in originally as the input.
Yes, that's correct.
Well,
we haven't really looked at the direction selectivity patterns much. The network has neurons which are directionally selective, and we haven't done much with them. We haven't studied them much at all. But it does have directionally selective neurons in it. That's true.
Yeah.
I don't know. We really haven't thought much about it and haven't paid too much attention to it.
It's not input.
No, it's not input. It's not input. And real neurons, of course, some of them are directionally selective, and the mechanisms for causing that and are important to understand, and also whether or not there's a direction map. And I guess there's probably not a direction map. Is that what people?
They observed one in the kittens, and then in the more mature cats, it becomes difficult to see. But I don't think that anybody is sure that it's not because of some technical problems.
The story with the direction maps is much more questionable than these orientation maps.
There's a whole difference, but maybe it just becomes even bigger, but still exists. And then
the lateral captains were symmetric?
Yes, in space.
In space. And what did you do about the boundary?
Periodic boundary conditions.
The map that you use in the beginning is the one symmetric?
Is the one of...
It's a map of orientation.
Yes. It's a periodic version of that little 2x2 1 millimeter squared thing that I showed you, except we move the pinwheels around so they sit in the center of the sub-period boxes. So it's a periodic idealization of that.
How do you make it periodic? You start with something which is not periodic.
Well, that's right. So that square should will explain. So R 1 millimeter squared is this square with four pinwheels, one at each at the center, and then periodically extended.
But on the edges, you will look at the orientation reference matching. So how do you do it?
Well, we selected the. I'm not sure this is necessary to do actually, but we selected the helicity of the pinwheel centers. So that you actually did continuously tile the plane. But I think if you look at the real data, the helicity is not continuously tiling. So but we chose it that way to make a periodic piece. Sometimes it seems to be, sometimes it seems not to be. So I'm not sure that's important, but it's how we made it periodic.
Pinwheel means that you just have a constant
Yeah, the angle, so it's at the center of the pinwheel, I should call it a wagon wheel. So at the center, these all like the same angle. This likes a neighboring angle, this likes a neighboring angle, and so forth. Yeah, that's right. Okay. So you shouldn't look at one or two neurons in these kind of studies. You should look at populations. If you're going to look at populations, you're going to need a measure of the, for example, the orientation selectivity. So Shapley's laboratory uses this circular variance measure of, so m is the firing rate as a function of theta. And this ratio of m2 to m0, he defines as what he calls the circular variance. The thing to look at right now is 2 points. First of all, it's a measure of height to trough. And secondly, when the CV is near 1, for example, when M is a constant, totally flat, it's a poorly tuned neuron. And when the CV is near 0, for example, when M is a delta function, as tight as you can have it, then it's a very well-tuned neuron. So this measure of tuning, if it's near 1, it's poorly tuned, and if it's 0, it's well-tuned. And this shows the histograms of from experiment. At the time this slide was prepared, there were, I think either 42 or 62 neurons in the left-hand database. Now Bob has several hundred, but I haven't updated this slide. And so you're plotting there circular variances, you're histogramming circular variance. So these are very well tuned neurons, and these are very badly tuned neurons. And the solid boxes are, these are presumably excitatory neurons. So the solid boxes on this side are the excitatory neurons in our network. So on the right-hand model, there's 16,000 neurons, or 12,000 neurons under the solid curve. And, you can see that, first of all, this dashed line is the CB of the input. So the input is very broadly tuned. And all of this spread is due to network activity. So that's the diversity that emerges from the network's activity. And the network does not tune as well as the experiment. But this is how it tunes. And you can see that it tunes substantially, but not as well as one might help. But we also see that the inhibitory neurons are much less. They're broader. And that's, I don't know how well that's confirmed with experiment. Most extracellular measurements, they don't discriminate between inhibitory and excitatory neurons. They believe they're talking to excitatory neurons because they're easier to measure and there's more of them. So the belief is that the left-hand box is basically excitatory neurons. So anyway, that's the histogramming up this this orientation selectivity. This shows you what it looks like across the layer. So that's our 1 millimeter squared of cortex. The left-hand side is firing rates. I'll just ignore that. The right-hand side is circular variance. And you can see that the distribution is a predominance of well-tuned neurons. Most of the well-tuned neurons are sitting very near the pinwheel singularity. This is the model. For one thing, it's very periodic. One of the predictions of the model is that you should have better tuning near singularities than away. So the first question is that observed in an experiment? And then secondly, what's the mechanism by which the model accomplishes that? Mm-hmm. And then, of course, is that mechanism relevant in the real cortex? So now there's not much data concerning that. There's data for CAP by Maldonado and Gray. They took an optical image, and then they started doing a single electrode, actually probably tetrode, penetration relative to that optical imaging. So they were combining physiology, electrophysiology with optical imaging. And so they divided their measured responses, their spike counts, their neurons, into two boxes, one that were close to the pinwheel singularities of the optical imaging by some dividing distance, it was far. And they looked at half-widths. And they could find no real change in half-widths as you moved between the two populations. So that was evidence that was against better tuning near the pinwheel singularity. However, Charlie lent us his data, and we did the same thing, but we didn't use half-widths, we used circular variance, which accentuates peak to trough. And so that's Charlie's data, but histogramming CVs rather than... So the first thing you see is that in CAP, the selectivity is very diverse. That fact, it is a fact, but it's never, that the opposite is emphasized in the literature for reasons that are not clear.
people will say that in CAP, particularly layer 4 in CAP, everything is well-tuned. And if you ask the experimentalists, they will say, well, that's not the case. This is more like what's the case. But then they don't quite tell you any more than that. But anyway, so you see that even in CAP, the orientation selectivity is very diverse. The dotted histogram is that subpopulation near the singularity, and the patch is a patch far from the singularity. And you can see that this histogram is consistent with our prediction using half-width. Now, there's a lot of caveats. First of all, there's not much data. Secondly, Charlie had three types of data depending on how long he averaged in time. And we took the longest time series. And so this is the smoothest of Charlie's data. And you get this very clear separation. If you choose either all of his data or the more rough part of his data, you don't see this at all. So I would say that the truth of the matter is that it's still out. But his half-width data does not contradict our theory as many people often tell us. But that's not the case.
So you have a stronger difference in the model than the distribution? Assuming that this kind
of... I don't know. Quantitatively... I don't know the answer to that question.
From the picture, the histograms wouldn't even overlap because all of the ones close to the videos are dark, already have dark spots.
This theory, this is real.
I'm asking you how similar it's an illusion. You have some dark spots also.
Yeah, so you're saying that near the pinwheel, the fact that this that we would not have this broad a distribution.
Yeah, maybe
near,
but
probably not. This is point 0.2 plus, and our CVs don't get down to 0.2 if you remember. They're sitting more at 0.6 or something like that, maybe. So that the peaks are certainly not going to be on top of each other. That's for sure.
So what are the values of the right now? The next slide. The most gray one is 0.6, you see.
Yeah, well...
Yeah, here, 0.6, 0.4. You don't go to 0.4,
right? Right. So in both experiments, in Bob's experiment where the CVs in this input layer get down to 0.2 or 0.4, and ours do not, and the same is consistent here. Sorry, going the wrong way. They get CVs down to 0.2 or so, and we don't get them down that low. So that's just a consistent sign that the model's not tuning enough. Now remember, the model's a single layer. Some of this tuning could be coming from interactions with other layers as well as totally lateral and so forth. It's not at all clear at this point in time. But the model does not tune enough. That's clear.
Is there a parameter or a set of parameters that trade-off the tuning? I mean, you can play with it.
And we haven't had much success with that. It's pretty robust, and it's pretty hard to get the tuning. This was about as good as we could tune with the present model in fiddling around with it.
Could it be just a general question? Could it be, your input, the tuning of the input is well established experimental, or could it be that it's better tuned in the input and this is what we need to change?
That's possible. We tried to use tuning that was... The input is, this depends on which camp you're in. There's a camp that believes the input's very badly tuned. We tend to be in that camp, so we chose tuning input that was consistent with that camp's view. There's another camp that views that the input is essentially all of the tuning, And so we could have tried narrowing the tuning. I'm not sure how much. We didn't do that, so like I can't really answer the input. But I.
After all, you're in one camp.
No? That's right. We're in one camp, not the other. So what we claim this does show, though, is two things. It shows, or three things. First of all, it shows that the lateral connections can lead to diversity. Secondly, they do tune, although as yet not enough. And thirdly, this interesting population result as to where the most tuned neurons are, which is really would demand more experiments to say yes or no.
I see that in your pinwheels is also a fluctuation, and actually change in the firing rates if you look at the left.
Yeah, that's correct. This is for
the pinwheels. So that's interesting.
This is for stimulation in at one angle. And so you see very bright response on one side and very dead response at the other side and so forth. But you're right, there is, the pinwheels tend to be hotter than away from the pinwheels.
And finally.
Yes, and that's a fact. Yeah.
You have a little
I will, if time permits, I will get to why that's the case. From using this coarse-grained representation to kind of see through how this is working in the model. And of course, then you've got to ask if that's the same mechanism, if that's a valid mechanism for the cortex. But in our model, we understand analytically where this where these firing rate hotspots and sharper selectivity is coming from.
It seems to me that the reason may be that you have strong inhibitory short-range interactions, and that's what the second prefers that things about close by should be.
Yeah, that's close to right. The actual story is here, intuitively not with the asymptotic reduction, but if you consider two pinwheels. Or two neurons, one near the pinwheel center and one away. This circle is the radius of the half width of the inhibitory connection. So this neuron is inhibited by all the inhibitory neurons in this disc, but all of them prefer the same angle, red. So this neuron is inhibited in a manner that's short range in cortical space. And short range in angle space. This neuron, on the other hand, is inhibited in a way that's short range in cortical space, but totally long range in angle space. And so that long range in angle space inhibition, global inhibition in theta, will cause sharpening. People understand that, and you see that clearly from the coarse-grained asymptotics. So it's this long range or global in theta the inhibition being global in orientation near the pinwheels, which is what leads to the sharpening. And so when experts see this picture, they understand where the sharpening is coming from right away. So now I want to leave orientation selectivity, and I want to turn to simple and complex cells. And so now it's time to break. Good. Tied to the stimulus, and so the way we hardwired things in and so forth made us believe that that's what we were doing. And Bob one afternoon said that we better check to see that these neurons are indeed simple cells like we thought they were, and it's not so clear they're going to be, because they're supposed to respond linearly, and yet all parts of them are nonlinear, and so some way the network conspires to produce a linear response if it's true. And the question is then, did our network do that? And the answer was yes, it did. And then we had to understand why, because it seemed to us kind of strange in retrospect that in fact they were responding linearly. So what exactly do I mean? Simple cells respond linearly to properties of the visual stimuli. Well, you're supposed to think about a kind of an input-output relationship, where the input is the grating, and the output is the neuron's response to that grating. And if the network itself was a linear filter, then if you had a standing grating, that the response would follow the phase of that standing grating. Temporally, if the grating was oscillating at the fundamental, then the response would only oscillate at the fundamental.
It's linear both in space and in time.
Yes, that's right. Although we'll be addressing mostly the temporal linearity because I didn't say it, but all of our neurons have the same receptive field center. We don't have the retinotopy map built in. So it's pretty difficult for us to study spatial linearity, but in the way the network is currently wired. Complex cells, on the other hand, respond the same in all phases and have large second harmonics. And so that's what I mean by linear. I don't really mean a linear device, but I mean that if you present a grating stimuli, it acts as if the input-output relationship acts as if it's a linear device in these two characteristics. So this is some old experiments, intracellular and extracellular. The left-hand side is extracellular and the right-hand side is intracellular. This is for standing wave gratings where the contrast is oscillating as a function of time. And you notice, just look at the extracellular. What's changing, so what's plotted here is the time over one period of the stimulus, and then a kind of an average response firing rate as a function of time averaged over the stimulus, over many presentations of the stimulus. Anyway, you see that as you vary the phase, this simple cell responds very differently depending on what the phase is. Whereas the complex cell has essentially the same response for all phases. Moreover, the simple cell responds at the fundamental in the sense that if there is a response, there's one, it looks like a rectified sign. Looks like the rectification of a sine wave. Whereas the complex response is frequency doubled. And these characteristics you can also see in intracellular measurements. So they're both extracellular spike counting properties and intracellular voltage properties.
So in the intracellular, you wouldn't see rectification, so you would just see inside of the cell.
That's right, and you're looking over two periods of the signal here. Or here you're looking over one period of the signal, so you should just erase the right of that curve. And then you can see that this is a simple cell, and it's basically a sinusoid. And it changes. Here it is at orthogonal. You can see there's almost no response. And then as you get down to the maximal response down here. So it's following the phase in a fundamental.
But also if you change the special shape, the special phase, you would also modulate the amplitude of this.
Yeah, that's, well, the spatial phase is being changed this way. And so you see it here. See here at one spatial phase, one spatial phase is essentially a flat signal. Orthogonal to that is the maximum. No, it's not orientation. This is time, and you should only look at half of it to see one period.
No, but the numbers, what are the numbers? Zero.
That's the phase of,
yeah,
it's the same phase. That's right. It's not orientation, it's phase.
So is that complex cell you can build by combining two simple cells?
Probably. We'll talk about how you might try to build a complex cell, but what trouble we're having with that. But first, I want to show you that the network really does contain simple cells, which from kind of first principle perspective is more surprising. In other words, it should be easier to build complex cells than it is to build simple cells in a network like this. We're finding that's not the case, but anyway, that should be, logically, that should be the case. So the fact that
if you disconnect the network, you get only simple cells. In terms of the inputs,
they would be simple. That's
all
right.
Of them will be perfectly simple.
So anyway, so let's that's not the case. That's not the case. I'm sorry. That's absolutely not the case. And this slide shows it. So this is just things from the model. And look at this column where the cortex has been shut off. So this is the response of one neuron to the drive. And in a moment we'll look at the cortex turned on. So we'll focus on this column first. Now this is intracellular, and these two are extracellular. So let's look at the extracellular first. Well, first of all, it does respond to phase. So the optimal phase, you get a nice robust response. And at orthogonal phase, you don't get such a robust response. So it's somewhat simple in that sense, because it is responding differently to different phase. On the other hand, in time, you see a pretty strong frequency doubling.
For orthogonal phase.
Which you should not see if it was a simple cell. And intracellularly, you see the same thing. Intracellularly, you see a nice sinusoidal response at optimal phase and a frequency doubled response at...
This is without the network, so this is what you put in. Yeah.
And it's the rectification that's doing it. It's the rectification of the LGN cells that's doing it.
So this, you model NGN cells also as being on off, and then you're...
Yes, that's right. And then we, and then we rectify them. So the input to the network, or alternatively the response of one neuron in isolation from the network, makes the thing look like someplace between a simple and a complex cell. If you recall, the true complex cells...
I also don't understand how the structure of the network. The input, the physical input to your network is given on pixels which are more or less like your retina, and then they're viewed by LGN and LGN.
That's right. That whole map from the screen to the input to the cortex is modeled with a transfer function that takes individual LGN neurons and computes their transfer function and then clips them and sums them in a way to build the orientational. That's right, with no orientation preference. So it's the combination of 20 or so LGN cells converging on one cortical cell that is imprinting the optical image the orientation map. So if you go back to the experimental complex cell, you see there's very little difference as you move from phase to phase to phase. Whereas in ours, whatever our cells are, they are phase discriminating, optimal and orthogonal. But still, there's far too much frequency doubling to really call them simple. Now when we turn the cortex on, these are the responses. You can see that extracellularly we've essentially killed the response, and intracellularly you've certainly diminished the frequency double component. So the network is producing simple cells from these kind of slightly wrong simple cells or something like that. So the next question is, what's the mechanism by which the network is doing that?
It's close to a winner-takes-all.
No, it's not that. It's not that. So this is how our network is working. Now, I'm not claiming this is how the brain works. I mean, I don't know. Okay. But this is how the network is working. So the way to think about it is to focus your attention on one cell and ask what input it's receiving. So it's receiving some LGN input, which I tell you is frequency doubled, and I'll show it to you in a moment. And it's receiving a lot of input from its neighbors. And so let's first look at the frequency, at the LGN input. So this is at orthogonal phase on this side, and this very clean line is the LGN input to that cell.
So you can see that it's rather robustly frequency doubled. Now what's also shown here is the excitatory and the inhibitory currents. And you can see that that they're both also frequency doubled. And what those are is the excitatory and inhibitory currents are all both cortical, and they're what's coming from their neighbors. And now the neighbors have their own preferred phase, which will not always be the same phase as this fellow. So for example, a typical neighbor might have might be at optimal phase. The grating might be at optimal phase for a neighbor, even though it was at orthogonal phase for the neuron in question. So the neighbor, it might be at optimal phase. If that's the case, this will be the response this will be how that neighbor drives this responds, and therefore how he drives this guy. It could be that there's also another neighbor that's 180 degrees out of phase from this optimal one. If that's the case, he will respond this way. And when you superimpose all of the random phases, you'll basically always be adding this to this. And that will give you a frequency double component by superposition, provided the optical map, the phase maps are quite irregular. Now remember, the orientation map was very regular. If you're sitting in a location, your neighbors basically like the same angle as you do, unless you happen to be a center of a pinwheel. But that's not true about phase. There is no good phase map. In fact, in recent measurements in Freeman's laboratory by DeAngelis, what they observe is that the phase distribution is broad. So nearby there's kind of a random sampling of all phases. And the reason these cortical currents are frequency doubled is because they're superpositions of guys that have one half with guys that have the other half. And indeed, the way we model our network, we put in these random phases into our hardwired coupling. So we put in two maps into our network. We put in the ordered map of the orientation and the random map of the neighboring phases. And it's the combination of it's the random map of the neighboring phases that in fact is linearizing or is producing this frequency double contribution. And then finally, the network is overbalanced for inhibition. So this is the ignore far and near. Just look at the red curves here. This is the excitatory current. And its value is not very big, well, relative to the, I'm sorry, conductance. So this is the excitatory conductance, cortical. And you can see that it's about 150 inverse seconds, and that's the units, or rather 50 inverse seconds is the units that I'm using for conductance. And here, the cortical guys are up around 200 inverse seconds. So the inhibition cortically is far larger than the excitation. So the cortical terms are dominated by inhibition. So they're both frequency doubled and they're dominated by inhibition. And that will tend to cancel, if the balances are just right, the LGN term, which is an excitatory frequency doubling. And so that's the way that our network produces simple cells, is through this combination of phase averaging coupled with inhibitorily dominated.
In that sense, you say gamma A versus gamma B will not make any difference?
I don't know. We've not coded in gamma B.
I know, but do you think that it might have a different?
I just can't say.
Because summation will be different.
In time, it would be quite different.
Not only in time, just because of the degrees versus
subtraction. I'm not so sure of that. Anyway, I can't really say. So anyway, the way the network builds simple cells is averaging over spatial phases. and the overbalance for inhibition. And indeed, if you weaken inhibition pharmacologically, you can convert simple cells to complex. So these are some references where they've done that. So that would be consistent with in our model. If you weaken inhibition, you would change simple cells into complex. So if this is consistent with these experimental measurements, of course, it doesn't say that the mechanism is really the same by any means. Now, we're trying to put complex cells into the model. When I wrote these slides, I was optimistic, but we still are having a lot of trouble with the complex cells. But let me tell you what the story is. So this,
how the receptive field of the simple cells in the model for in a bar?
Yeah, we can't. The present way we've modeled things, we can't really test that because our entire network has the same receptive field. So all of these neurons, we don't have retinotopy built in. So we haven't really tried bar stimulus yet because we want to first put in retinotopy before we can really address that. So the spatial nature of the simplicity, we can't really address at this point in time, which is why we're addressing the temporal nature. But that's a point, and we've got to get retinotopy in it.
You mean you can put in whatever you want in terms of the spatial properties?
No, it's just that every neuron has the same receptive field center
in your model.
In our model. And so to try to use things like bar stimuli and start moving around and ripping apart, it doesn't seem like we ought to be doing that until we get that. A true retinotopy built in.
But then you have to multiply your hypercodons, right?
Well, that's kind of my last slide. We have to, you know, that's why we have to combine this kind of fine scale modeling with coarse graining as well in order to really build a model that will scale up to an interesting patch of the cortex. Any case, so this reminds you once again of the way simple cells are built. And now, the complex cells are just, so how are we going to build those? Well, you're going to weaken and vary the LGN input. So you're going to weaken and vary the drive for the complex cells. Simple cells, you'll keep driving the same way. But the simple cells, you'll weaken and vary the drive. And you'll also, so what's going to excite the complex cells is got to be the simple cells, because they're what's being really driven by the drive. And so if they're going to act well, you're going to have to make the cortical excitation stronger. So you're going to weaken the feed-forward drive for the complex part of the network, and you're going to strengthen the cortical excitation. And so that's our strategy, is to build a network consisting of both simple and complex cells, but where the simple part of the network is more or less what we've got, and where the complex part of the network has these two features different from the network that we currently have. So I've been talking about contrast reversal stimulation, so standing gratings, but now I want to play the same game but for drifting gratings. In drifting gratings, the way you tell a simple from a complex cell is the ratio of F1 to F0. So a simple cell will have a lot of F1, a lot of the first harmonic. And therefore, F1 over F0 will be large. A complex cell will have very little F1, a lot of F0, and therefore F1 over F0 will be small. So now I'm switching to drifting rather than to. So the measure is slightly different. But this is this ought to read more than preliminary. This ought to read very preliminary or something. But when we wrote these slides, this is where we were. So. This left-hand side is measurements from Shapley's laboratory over all of V1. And this is the breakdown of simple and complex cells throughout all six layers of V1, pooled together. And you can see that over all of V1, there's more complex cells than simple. If you restrict this to 4C alpha, then it's about 50-50. Now, that's different than what people will tell you. They'll tell you in cat it's nearly 100% simple cells in 4. But in monkey, at least, Bob's absolutely certain it's about 50-50 in the input layer 4C alpha. And in cat, he suspects that it also is there's a lot more complex cells in the input layer than people report. But in any case, in monkey, it's a fact. And so this distribution, if I would have drawn it for 4C alpha, would have been 50-50, still bimodal. Now the bimodality could be an artifact of the fact this is an extracellular measurement, and so the rectification will produce a bimodality from a continuous distribution. So the fact it's bimodal could be just an artifact.
Why is that?
You kind of have to compute it, but if you start with the following model, if you say, I believe the firing rate, the extracellular firing rate, is just a thresholded function of the intracellular voltage. And then you ask yourself, if the intracellular voltage has F1 over F0 that's uniformly distributed, so kind of an equal number of simple and complex cells in a continuous grading, what would be the firing rate that goes with, what would be the distribution of firing rates? The rectification will give you a bimodal distribution. Ringotsch and Meckler worked this out in some detail recently, and it, of course, worries Bob immensely, because all extracellular measurements have been very proud of the fact that the simple complex distribution is not only a continuum, but is bimodal. And is bimodal, but it's bimodal with respect to extracellular measurements, and intracellular measurements, you don't have enough to do a population histogram, and so you... You kind of don't know whether it's an intracellular property, bimodality is an intracellular property or not. But in any case,
Fossi beta shows the same 50-50.
Yeah, you know, I shouldn't say absolutely, but roughly.
But Fossi beta.
Yeah, I know, I remember it as being still 50-50, but since I'm focusing on 4C alpha, I may remember it wrong. But that's.
Fossi beta, the cells are not oriented in terms of the cells.
Yeah, it's the parvo layer, and I think they're not oriented, or at least not oriented as well. They are oriented according to the distributions that I was showing. There is some orientation in 4C beta, I believe, but I haven't focused on it, so I don't. So anyway, this is the distribution we had at the time that this 4C alpha. So you can see that at the time we had too many complex cells, and we were having difficulty getting cells that were complex and properly orientationally selective. Now the complex cells are not as orientation selective as the simple cells, that's a fact, but they're more orientation selective than the ones we were producing. So we were focusing on trying to get better orientation selective complex cells. But then we discovered how our network was working, and it was synchronizing. And so when we added more excitation in order to get complex cells, what happened was the drive drove the sub-network of simple cells very nicely. Complex cells were quiescent. Shouldn't have been. Anyway, as the drive continued, pretty soon the strong cortical excitation would cause the complex cells to start to fire. But the way they were firing is the whole damn network of complex cells, that whole sub-network, fired together. Boom. Then the inhibition took over after they fired a while and killed, brought them back to that sub-network, was dead for a while. How long? Well, it depended on the length of the inhibition. And then the process would repeat. So you'd have this crazy network where it was too synchronized. And at the moment, we're still trying to get rid of that synchrony. And so I've been talking with David about that. But so at the moment, we've been unable to build complex cells, because when we make the network a better amplifier, as everybody that does network stuff knows, it tends to synchronize. And you don't want it to synchronize. And so you've got to figure out how to break that synchrony. So it turns out that building complex cells is harder, at least for us, than building simple cells, although, and the reason is that building a good cortical amplifier is hard for us. And that's the status of it. So
what you described happens during the drive.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Not spontaneous.
No, we get
about the right, we're able to tune the network with some work to get about the right distributions of spontaneous firing rates for both the simple and the complex parts of the network. And it was fine, it was asynchronous and so forth. But when we started driving, then it was no good. And that's the status now. So that's what we're currently really focusing on in a major way.
Synchrony was exhibited in terms of the curling wave?
No, the whole, remember we have this square. So the whole damn population of the sub-network that's complex is at rest or at background. No,
what about the simple cells?
Simple cells don't really show much effect. They just kind of oscillate correctly. They must feel the rapidly firing complex cells in some way, but nothing drastic was happening to the simple cells. But the complex cells had this very abnormal behavior that we're still struggling with. So now I want to turn to high conductances. So we look at Meckler's background firing statistics, and we use it to kind of tune the model. So now I'm back, no complex cells, only simple cells, so the original model I was talking about. And what we discover is that when we get the firing rates about right, that the background conductances are 2 to 3-fold stronger than the bare conductances. So the network conductance coming into a given neuron, primarily driven by external noise, is that much bigger than just the bare leakage values. And in addition, when you stimulate with high contrast gratings, you pick up another factor of 2 or 3. So the conductance coming into a given neuron is 2 to 3 times higher than it is in background due to high contrast stimulation. And of course, the reason is that conductance feels all the neighbors firing, and the neighbors are firing fast enough that it lifts that conductance. Moreover, when you look at the breakdown of the inhibitory cortical conductance to the excitatory cortical conductance, by far most of the conductance is in the inhibitory component. Now, all of these are consistent with kind of this current observations and theoretical speculations that's around in the literature. What's listed here are entirely experimental observations, and deal more with this part of the slide, picking up this 2 to 3-fold increase over background, and that increase is primarily inhibitory. So when our network kind of works right, when it tunes as best as we can make it tune, when it has simple cells in it and so forth, and we look, this is what the conductances are. So people think that we're tuning it by placing it in that system. We certainly essentially are, but we can't just arbitrarily place it in this high conductance state, or it wouldn't pass the rest of the performance criteria. So
in terms of the synapses that you have on the neurons, do you have more inhibitory synapses in the excitatory lines?
No, actually less, although you have to... Actually less, although... So the number of excitatory neurons... So an excitatory neuron and an inhibitory neuron don't differ in our modeling with the number of synapses. So we treat the number is the same on each. However, the number of inhibitory neurons are only 20-25% of the total number. So there's many fewer inhibitory neurons, and therefore there'll be fewer inhibitory synapses. In addition, the circle of influence is smaller. So I think that will also bring down the number of synapses. So actually there are fewer by quite a bit of the inhibitory couplings. They are much stronger by this factor of 9. So that's why I was really saying that you ought to define an effective S matrix, and it would still be over-dominated for inhibition, but nowhere near like 1.9, but more like 1.25 or something like that. So I'm glad you mentioned that. So that's precisely the point here, that this makes it look terribly inhibitorily dominated, but it's not when you do this count that you asked me just to do, but still it is inhibitorily dominated.
How do you define this dominance?
Well, this is one way, just looking at the values of the conductors. And so here we've ripped apart the conductances into five parts. The LGN drive, which is, you can see why we're not in the marginal mode of the Sopolinsky language. We're really driving very hard. So it's much more like a perturbation of a feed-forward network. The red is the excitatory noise. This is what we're using together with the inhibitory noise to fit the background level of firing. If you like to hold the cortex alive in the absence of stimulation. And then the red is the excitatory and inhibitory terms. So here, this is background or spontaneous, and then at this point in time, we flash on a drifting grating. And so you can see the balances or in background or spontaneous balances and the balances under stimulation. Now look under stimulation. The cortical inhibition, this unit it bothers people. It's in inverse seconds. So we think of G as setting a time scale. And so 400 inverse seconds as compared with 20 or 30 inverse seconds of the excitation. And so you can see that there's a big dominance at the conductance level for inhibition. The currents are much more balanced if you keep track of the VEs and VIs. But the conductances are really heavily... and so you see then the total conductance jumping by factors of 2 and 3 when you flash on the visual stimulation. And you see that it's dominated in the model by inhibition, both of which are consistent with, say, Judith Hirsch or with Borg Graham's recent measurement.
It looks like the inhibitory neurons should have a much higher rate.
They have a higher rate, but not much higher.
I just don't see how the numbers match. They have nine times stronger synapses, but you have like
40. Well, but remember, the 9 is built into the G. So you're not multiplying this by 9, it's already been multiplied by 9.
Yeah, but you have four times less interneurons.
Yeah.
So twice is pretty strong.
It's about 2, but this is like 400 versus...
It's much stronger.
It's much stronger. Yeah. Right. So
but the numbers are, I don't know, but the numbers come out to be, say 40, 50 spikes per second versus 60, 70 spikes per second. 25, 30 spikes.
It is because of the reversal potential.
Could be. I don't know. I don't know. But the numbers come out to be about right.
So this is a pre-factor, but you have also reversal potential.
That's right. That's right. Okay. Now what that means is that there's a separation of time scales, and it's activity induced, which is what I think is quite interesting. What happens is in background or in spontaneous. So what are the two time scales? Well, the two fastest time scales are the synaptic time scale, which is, say, 4 milliseconds, and this moving time scale, which is the total conductance. And in spontaneous activity with no visual stimulation, this number is about 4. So these two time scales are roughly the same. And then when you high contrast stimulate, you drop the one number by factors of 2 or 3, which means that you're starting to see a scale separation. Now, changing things from 2 milliseconds to 4 milliseconds, you might think, well, that can't really be a scale separation. But watch what happens. If there was a scale separation, then the voltage would be slave to this effective reversal potential. And that is the sub-threshold voltage when the thing is not firing. And you can see that quickly. This is the differential equation, which is a linear equation for V. So if you make the linear part explicit, then this coefficient is G total. It's the sum of all of these G's. And be effective, you can work out the formula for it, and it's this. So if G is big, bringing it over to this side, 1 over g is small, so this term will be near 0, and therefore v has to be approximately v effective.
There's a
minus sign. I missed a minus sign. It would help if I would have typed it right. Yeah, there's a minus sign here. So V very quickly relaxes to V effective. And how quick is that relaxation time? 1 over G. And so that's what this says, is that if this inverse time is much, much shorter than the synaptic times upon which this G is oscillating, then you'll have this formula. And of course, you won't have this formula if G is roughly the size of tau synaptic, because that's the rate at which these internal G's are oscillating. Or if you like, that's the rate at which V effective is oscillating. And so so we might ask if our network is really slave like that, because there's no reason to expect a factor of 2 would work. So for that, just look at this panel and this panel. This is background, and the green curve is the, in fact, you probably should look at this panel. The green curve is spontaneous firing of spikes. 3 spikes are fired in this range of time. And the red curve is the V effective. Now, you might say that's pretty well slaved when it's not firing. It looks pretty good. But when you turn on the network and make it really fire, then you see you get a really an incredible slaving whenever the thing is subcritical. And so this factor of 2 is enough to really slave the network, and really does produce the relaxation times, which are faster than the synaptic times in this network. Now, whether or not that's true in the cortex remains to be seen, but the increase by factors of 2 to 3 is consistent with, over background, is consistent with measurements.
Increasing what? Again?
Increasing the total conductance by factors of 2 and 3 over background. So if the background is at the synaptic time, if the background's conductance is really the synaptic time scale in the cortex, then this is happening in the cortex. but I don't know that the background conductance is really 1 over the synaptic time scale in the cortex. Now this is just a toy that we built to illustrate that if G was too small, you'd get essentially no slaving of the spiking neuron, the green curve, to the effective potential. In fact, what you're getting is a kind of a local averaging in time. So if you look at the red line, it kind of is going through an average of the green and the red lines are kind of averages of each other. So in a certain sense, this thing is acting like an integrator, where it's kind of locally averaging. This is when the two are about the same, and you see more slaving than you might have guessed. And this is when the thing has emerged, and you really see a very nice slaving. And so the conclusion is that within this network, activity produces a separation of time scales, which could change integrators to coincidence detectors. And so that's the story. And then just quickly,
can you go back?
Yeah. This issue of, if you think of a neuron as a kind of an input-output device, the time scale of its output is roughly 1 over G. 1 over its G, not its G leakage, but the effective G in network. So if you double that time, if you have that time scale, a neuron will have time to spike twice. Or if you quarter it, a neuron will have time to spike 4 times. And so these high G neurons will tend to burst in that sense. Perhaps it's not the bursting of a Hodgson-Huxley neuron, but nevertheless, it's a little burst of spikes that the number of which is inversely proportional to G. And that's what I mean by a burst generator.
And coincidence?
Here I have in mind that
once again, the time a coincidence detector, think of it as coming in. The time resolution of it coming in is tau synapse. And if G is responding much faster than tau synapse, then at least tau synapse will be the resolution of the coincidence detector. So it's not 1 over G that's the resolution of your coincidence detector, but it's tau synapse. But if 1 over G is much smaller than tau synapse, then the thing can do that as a coincidence detector. So but it's not true that 1 over G is your resolution of the coincidence detector, but rather tau synapse.
And what's the factor that makes it so sensitive to the difference between 2 and 4?
I don't know. I knew that once G got big enough, we'd slave. But when I heard from Jim Wiedlard, who was doing the numerics, the fact that you only picked up a factor of 2, I thought, well, it won't slave. And so that's kind of where we're at. I mean, it's surprising to me that it slaves this well.
It's
definitely a network effect, because the reason G is so big and the reason that 1 over G is so small is because of the simultaneous firing of all these neurons. You know,
what is known experimentally in this burst?
I don't know. They ought to know how it's related to the local G, but I don't know.
But I mean, this is. It's kind of small burst.
I don't know. I don't have any idea.
And in the simulations, what could be the correction of variation?
I don't know. It's quite regular, I believe, because this effective reversal potential goes up and comes down, and you just fit in as many spikes as you can with distances 1 over G in there. So it's a very regular bursting in time. And the only irregularity is the irregularity of that slower time scale, which is synaptic, right? Of the V effective. So it's a very, very regular bursting when it happens.
It's going to be a short burst because you're going to have such a big
effect. And it is a short burst, that's right. That's right. I just want to say just a little bit about coarse graining, then I'll quit. So rather than studying these, if you want to do analysis, you're going to have to get a different representation than 16,000 point neurons. And so our next thing that we decided to do is to try to coarse grain the network to get an equations for local firing rates. So in the process of coarse graining the network, we first thought that we can't throw away the cortical maps because we'd be filling out the baby with the bath. And so the coarse graining, the size of the coarse grain cells is going to be related to the optical imaging maps. So I just remind you that the optical imaging map was rather regular, and therefore, you can kind of see if you define your coarse grain cell to be centered at a pinwheel singularity with some kind of a polar coordinate system, then throughout this cell you want the angles to be roughly the same, and you hope the cell can be made big enough to hold a great many neurons. So step one is to spatially coarse grain using polar coordinate systems that are centered on the pinwheel singularity. And then we'll use this separation of time scales to coarse grain in time. And finally, not all maps are regular, but this phase map, for example, is a very random map. And so we've got to keep some of the maps very random. So within a typical coarse grain cell, all of the neurons may like the same angle, but their phase will be quite different. So the phase is going to have to remain a random variable inside the cell in the coarse graining process. So we did that. And a cartoon of the equations that we get
is here. Now this is just a cartoon in order to kind of unveil the structure of the equations, but the true equations are far more nonlinear than just than what's written here. So this is an equation for two firing rates, an excitatory firing rate ME and an inhibitory firing rate MI of neurons in cell X. So this X is a label of the two-dimensional coarse grain cell. So in cell X, this is the average firing rate of the excitatory neuron. And it satisfies these kind of Cowan-Wilson-like equations, where in this idealized example, I've used the nonlinearity being just rectification. But now the type of equations they are, they're integral equations, the integrations over space and time, which rear its head from this, the G that's here. Being space-time separable, and you can see that it's going to end up being a space-time convolution that's going to emerge from that, and that's the type of and that's what this star means, a space-time convolution. The other thing I wanted to point out, though, is that they depend on not the firing rates, but the average over phi of the firing rates in the cell. So we phase average inside the nonlinearity. And that arises because of this sum, summing up a lot of contributions, some of which are at different phases, and therefore this sum ends up self-phase averaging when you play with it a little bit. And so what you get is this sort of an integral equation for the coarse-grained firing rate. And with that, you can start doing analysis. And I won't. I was going to go through some of the analysis, but I won't. It's getting too late. But you can, for example, clearly see the meaning of global innovation in theta space and how it leads to better tuning than away from the pinwheel singularities and so forth. You can see that quite quickly. And so, what can you do with these coarse grain equations? Well, you can understand. Yeah.
This equation assumes that this fixed point of the so-called wave moment.
Yeah, these are space-time convolutions. So, where the but yeah, I think they
the limit of slow synapses and.
Let me say, so the usual rate models, right, dm by dt equal a minus a constant m plus a term. And if you set dm by dt equal to zero, you get these type of equations.
Yeah.
We believe that the dynamics inside these, that dynamics is artificial, where this dynamics in terms of these space-time convolutions, the time part of the convolution, is more real. But
again, formally you will get the same type of equation if you assume that the synapses are slow.
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. Yeah.
It is
a rate model. No, it is a
so the differential is that you have the average of the fitness related to the
that's the two things that are different. Well, three things we think are different. The biggest difference is that. The second is that these convolutions are space-time over the synaptic times. So we're not averaging out synaptic times here, because the approximation was based on 1 over G being small, not on the synaptic times being small. Therefore, we think you shouldn't add to this some kind of dm by dt, but rather the time evolution on the synaptic scales is already in here.
And the MPs themselves are not new degrees of freedom.
The MPs themselves are, they're not new degrees of freedom. So each neuron has a firing rate. So instead of using voltage, you might try to write equations for pointwise firing rates. Or you might coarse grain and write equations for averaged firing rates over the little coarse grain patch. And that's what these guys are. So
do they have, so you will write the dynamics of these guys?
And the dynamics of these, that's correct. The dynamics of these guys on the synaptic time scale is governed by these equations.
because the reduction was on the 1 over g time scale, which is even faster by this factor of 2, but anyway. You can, if the kernels of the k are like exponentials, you can write them as a differential equation. But the kernel won't be an exponential; it'll be an alpha function or something like that. So that's right. These are integral space-time convolutions. I mean integral equations in both space and time. They're causal. They're causal integral equations, but they're integral equations.
But I see that if you take the right variables, so you will finish with and you convert the integral equation.
Then you'll get that kind of an equation.
You get but of equations,
right. That's correct. That's correct. And if the temporal kernel of the k is just a pure exponential, then you'll get the first order rate model. And if it's not, you'll get a higher order rate model. That's correct. That's what they are. And the other thing, though, is that they retain the pinwheel architecture. That's hidden in this LGN, FLGN. And so it's not kind of an all-to-all rate model, but it's a rate model that retains the pinwheel architecture. But
in some sense, it's more interesting if you do not reduce to the other expression, because then it says that you have a new effective degree of behave like a neuron.
Yeah, but I think that these are very similar in that sense. And certainly, if you use exponential kernels, they're exactly the other rate model. I think that is right. Yeah. So anyway, so you can use them to do analysis and understand the balances that give rise to simple and complex cells. You can do input-output relations at high conductance, firing rates as a function of drive, and so forth. There's a lot of models of the cortex, and they're hard to compare. But if you take each of them and do this coarse-grained reduction, and get down to kind of idealized rate models, then you can kind of start comparing these different models. So I actually think for theoretical comparison of how different models are working, this reduction is important. And let me emphasize that we don't posit the rate model. We start with the large-scale dynamical system, and we reduce it to the rate model. So there's not additional parameter fitting going on. The rate model will have the same parameters as the original fine scale system. But really, the most important use is that it's much faster to integrate. And therefore, if you start trying to scale up to larger models, you're going to have to do some combination of this fine scale modeling with rate equation modeling, or something else that replaces rate equation with some sort of a global parameterization. And this just reminds you that if you... the beautiful work of Fitzpatrick's from Fitzpatrick's laboratory showing the heterogeneity of the long-range connections. And so if you want to do so let me just talk a little about where we're going to go. So the idea is to build a multi-layer model. So what I wanted to do was begin with this little millimeter square patch of cortex and add two layers to it, an input layer, perhaps 4B, an output layer, perhaps 4B, and an input layer for C alpha, and a feedback layer 6. But as soon as you get out to things like 4B, and in particular when you get to 2, 3, you realize that the interesting structures are much longer than 1 millimeter squared. So it's a little artificial to build a 3... Okay. Keeping it that local, if you want to go to multi-layers, you have to get it slightly larger. And therefore, you're certainly going to have to build in things like retinotopy, because it might be all right to ignore retinotopy over a millimeter. Certainly not all right to ignore it over 3 millimeters. So we have to take this single-layer model and enlarge it from maybe 1 millimeter to 3 millimeters squared, and then couple it to at least 2, perhaps 3 other layers, if we're really going to have a kind of a realistic model. Now, the turnaround time for that sort of numerical experiment would be just humongous. The whole beauty of computer experiments is you can do a lot of them, adjusting parameters and so forth, that take much longer than real experiments. And that would probably not be the case for that construction. So what we think is we have to start over and do both. I don't want to do only a rate model, because there's some things that are only capturable by point neurons. So what I want to do is kind of embed a point neuron model in a backgrounded rate model.
You have your intrinsic signal, like the rate model, and you have your penetrating electrode,
like... Or something like that, that's right. So anyway, as soon as you see this kind of beautiful experiment, you really come to grips with the fact that you've got to get non-local effects into the modeling. And also what I'd like to do is elementary optical illusions, the most elementary ones. Now, I don't know that they really take place in V1 or not, but let's ask, could they? And if you're going to do that, then your space scales have to be several millimeters. They can't be just 1 millimeter. So every place that we want to go, it begins with a slightly larger lateral extent and then a multi-layer coupling. And so that's kind of where we're going. But before we go any place, we want to get these complex cells. And we really are frustrated by the way the network is latching up on us when we build these complex cells. So anyway, that's where that work is.
Are you going to include any
animals? I don't know, but you know, with John Renzel there, he constantly is telling me if you don't start putting feedback into the LGN, you're missing something that's serious. And so so probably one of the first things we will do, if the reason Bob doesn't want us to put feedback into the LGN is he keeps asking, what's it doing? You know, let's first figure out what it's doing.
You should find out by modeling, maybe.
Well,
you
know? Yeah, but then the modeling can But then the modeling can run away from experimental reality, and so I don't know. Anyway, Bob's been hesitant to allow us to start putting in feedback because he would like to know what at least the conjecture was that it was doing in the visual system before he built it in, but John has been pushing us to put in some LGN feedback. Renzel.
So there must be some conjectures about what he's doing.
Well, that's why I was so interested in his talk yesterday. I mean, Bob would say that it's totally open, but of course Bob won't believe anything until it's experimentally he would say it's just totally open. The only thing that he grants is that there's a huge number of connections. It goes from 6 back to the LGN. And
they do something like it's totally untrue.
But anyway, Bob would argue that it's just totally open. And Bob worries about modeling that runs ahead of too far ahead of experiment.
But then you can predict. I mean, this is
you can predict.
It's a you can tell the experimenters, but yeah. Look, this could do this and this and that. Let's check it.
But if we were doing first principles biophysics, then I'd agree with you completely. But this is so phenomenological, this type of modeling, because it's systems neuroscience, and so it really is.
There are too many degrees of freedom that people do.
And you're not. If you're modeling a few neurons, you can do a very good job with what I'd call fundamental biophysics modeling. But as soon as you start going to a large system, it becomes more like ecology. It's very much a phenomenological. Now, if you're going to do phenomenological models, that's fine. Like that's what we're doing, but then I think you've got to be only a few steps ahead, if you like, of experiment.
Yeah, it's only one step ahead.
Well,
one
that's
step
probably ahead. True. That's what John says. but it's true that we don't. Another thing that I talked about why we did primary visual cortex, but I didn't say, and of course it's obvious you start with the input layer, but the input layer has a lot of advantages for modeling. So there aren't so many long range connections. There's almost no projections coming from places like V2, V4 down to 4C alpha, and so you have the network slightly more isolated than you do if you start modeling 2-3, where you've got to ask, is there any reason you can model a network containing 2-3 without also modeling V2 or V4?
So you talk about unilayer. But even within a layer, let's say 4C or alpha, it's a three-dimensional structure.
Yes, that's right.
There's no effect, and you talk only about...
Yeah, I don't know. Jenny Loon splits up now particularly layer 4C for C alpha, I think. She splits into high alpha, middle alpha, and she's finding different types anatomically of neurons and their connections in these different layers. And the amount of stuff coming from the LGN changes as you go from...
But even if you look at the geometry itself, you just expand the third dimension, then your numbers will now scale to a different amount.
But the numbers we used were anatomical, so they were
per layer.
Yeah, that's right. They were counted per layer and laid on a sheet of paper, but projected down. Yeah. Primarily, we used, I can't pronounce his name, Boulier or. Bouillet's data for that. Anyway.